Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before I call the case, Marshall, did you advise Justice Wilcox?
No, he's not sitting.
He's not participating.
Okay, that ends that. Good morning. I'm delighted to welcome with us this morning students from Wayland Academy. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. Wayland Academy is a school that often comes to our oral arguments, and they're here at the Court with Class program. This program invites students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. The basis of the discussion is a case that we will hear at the time that they are able to come. They're given the briefs, and they may do other activities in connection with this case. This program has won national awards, and we are very proud of it and therefore delighted to welcome our students. As part of the program, the students will meet with a justice right after this oral argument. The discussion at that time will be about the procedures of the case and the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. And everyone is invited to attend that session afternoon. Let me introduce the justices to you. On my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. In the empty chair ordinarily is Justice Wilcox. He has an easy morning. He is not participating in this case either. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser after this case. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. We'll now proceed to our second case today, 2004 AP188, AKG Real Estate LLC versus Kosterman. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Kosterman is Daniel Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, may it please the court. My name is Daniel Kelly. And it is my honor to represent Patrick and Susan Kosterman. An unconditional easement created by express grant is not terminable simply because the easement owner subsequently acquires a means of satisfying the purpose of the easement by an alternative means. The Court of Appeals, however, held to the contrary, and in doing so rejected this Court's binding precedent, upset generations of real property relationships, and deprived easement owners of bargain for benefits, both ancient and new, without compensation, and in violation of their constitutionally guaranteed rights. For this, the Court of Appeals should be reversed, and for three reasons. The first is this. The Court of Appeals attempted to overrule this Court's decision in Niefeld v. Evans, a case that specifically held that serving estate owners may not unilaterally terminate easements simply because there is another means of accomplishing the purpose of the easement. Second, the Court of Appeals adopted the corrosive concept of the doctrine of changed circumstances as against express easements. And even if this Court was interested in considering that doctrine, importing that into the law of the state of Wisconsin, this is not the proper vehicle to do so, because as a matter of law, there have been no changed circumstances in this case. And finally, the Court of Appeals must be reversed because their decision constitutes a taking within the meaning of the Wisconsin and United States constitutions. It took a property right from one individual, gave it to another, and it did so without just compensation.
That was the action of the court.
That was the action of the court. And it has been the law in the United States for over 100 years that a court order can constitute a taking.
It's a little blurry. Here we go.
This is the language of the easement that is issued before this court today. It is an unconditional easement. There is no condition subsequent. It is a standard easement for ingress and egress. And in this case, it serves the purpose of access between the Kosterman House and Highway 31. It was created in 1961. It served this purpose in 1961. It serves that purpose today. And there's no indication it will stop serving that purpose tomorrow.
Your position is that your clients, if they wish to, can sell this right, but unless and until they do, this is the easement that controls based upon the language assigns forever. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the reason for that is this. This court has specifically held in the past, in Niefeld v. Evans, that easements that are acquired by prescription or by express grant cannot be unilaterally terminated. And that case is remarkably similar to this one. In that case, Mr. Niefeld came to the court, asked for the termination of an easement across his property because the dominant estate owner had subsequently acquired access to his property via a public road. Very similar to what AKG's argument is in this case. They say here, the Kosterman's easement should expire upon provision of public road access. But that is not what this court does with expressly granted easements. In fact, the court said this, quote, the rule that the right ceases with necessity has no application to ways acquired by express grant or by prescription. A right to a way so created cannot be defeated by showing that the owners have another convenient and accessible way of going to and from their premises.
Mr. Kelly, do you think that the change condition doctrine that's set forth in the restatement is the trend, is what is being adopted across the country at this point?
I do not believe it's a trend. The case cited by AKG, MPM Builders, purports to set out what it called the trend. It cited to four cases. Two of those dealt with easements of necessity and the location thereof, and the others, only one specifically adopted changed circumstances as the law. The other two cases stated that the restatement reflected what the law already was in those states. So I don't think there's any trend in that direction. There are some states that subscribe to the minority view that serving estate owners may relocate or terminate easements, but that's not the law in the state of Wisconsin. And this court's statement in Niefeld v. Evans simply cannot be reconciled with what the Court of Appeals did in this case, because the Court of Appeals said this, quote,
Let me stop you at this point. Certainly the Court of Appeals decision seems to set forth a number of relatively persuasive arguments in regard to Wisconsin adopting the change condition doctrine. And as you know, it's certainly appropriate for this court to look at whether or not the policy expressed almost 50 years ago in the Niefeld case is policy that is good now for the state of Wisconsin. How do you respond to the arguments made in the Court of Appeals decision based on policy?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals, to the extent that it was making a policy argument, was arguing in a vacuum because there are no changed circumstances in this case. They found that there are potentially two changed circumstances. One, the provision of public road access to the Kosterman property. Two, the adoption of Wisconsin Administrative Code, Section Trans 233. The first one's irrelevant, as stated in Niefeld. The second condition that they found to be a changed circumstance, and the one upon which they concentrated, is incorrect as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals mistakenly assumed that Trans 233 had been adopted in 1999, 1 year after AKG acquired its property. But that's not the case. Trans 233 was repealed and recreated in 1999, but the operative language of that statute, of that administrative code, has existed in the state of Wisconsin since 1956. have on the screen before you now a comparison of the language between Section Highway 33.06, as it existed in 1956, and on the right side, the language from Trans 233.06, as it exists today. The Court of Appeals found that this administrative code prohibited the construction of a public road on the path of the easement, and they found that to be a changed circumstance. 233.06, as you can see, regulates the amount of distance that must occur between intersections and state trunk highways, and it sets that distance at approximately 1,000 feet. But as you can see in paragraph 2 of Highway 33.06, the same 1,000-foot provision appears there as in the second paragraph of Trans 233.06. It is exactly the same provision.
But Mr. Kelly, I understand your factual argument here, but I'm more interested in hearing a response to Justice Crook's question regarding the policy underlying the Court of Appeals decision and why we should not be looking in that direction.
Well, I think the McMeekin case from Georgia in 2000 very persuasively demonstrated why we should not adopt the doctrine of changed circumstances, and that is because of this. When you do that, you are, first off, you're creating a windfall for the serving the state owner. Presumably, parties who contract operate in the legal regime extant at that period of time. They understand what the benefits and detriments are that they are bargaining for, and they pay commensurately. If we now go back and say, actually, you didn't get the certainty that you thought you were bargaining for, that means that the dominant estate owner was paid too little, and the serving estate owner received too much, and they've received a windfall. Now, in the state of Wisconsin, we have, for the past 150 years, treasured our predictability and stability in our real property law, and for a very, very significant reason, and it is this. There is a mountain of capital that is built on real property laws in this state. When we think about changing those laws, the likelihood is that you will dislodge some of that capital from that mountain and it will crash and be destroyed. What AKG is asking for in this case is to acquire property rights today that it did not pay for in 1998. And it's asking this court to accomplish that purpose for it. It is asking, in essence, for a windfall, which goes to why this is also a takings. But with respect to the policy, what we've done now, if we adopt this doctrine of changed circumstances, we would devalue every single easement that exists out there, because what we would be saying is that it is only as secure as your ability to persuade a court that you can make better use of your property rights than your neighbor. What it does is it essentially puts those property rights in a constant state of flux. Any two parties could come to this court, one saying, my neighbor has property rights that I could put to more valuable use than him. Give it to me, please. And that's not our law, nor should it be. It introduces a constant state of flux that will be destructive to our ability to foment the economy and to secure the kind of capital that has been based on the predictability and stability
Kelly,
of property law.
Could I ask you a question? This started out as about 80 acres of land. Husband and wife own that, and they give 4 acres to their son and daughter-in-law, and they grant an easement. It's my understanding that the people who got those 4 acres ultimately took ownership, at least in part, of the whole 80 acres. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, does the fact that the so-called dominant estate and servient estate are owned by the same people, does that affect the easement?
It does not in this case. If the same parties were the fee owners of both the dominant and servient estates, then the easement would merge and expire at that point. But that's not the case here. There was actually a tenancy in common between the Kwilichucks and another part of the family, the Whites. So there was not that unity of ownership that would require for the doctrine of merger to take effect in this case. So that that semi-common ownership had no effect on the easements.
So if the original husband and wife had only had one child, say, and that child and his wife inherited everything, there'd be a different result from what you're arguing?
It would be a different result, and for a very good reason. Because the doctrine of merger operates because there is the understanding that once you own all of the property involved in the dominant and the serving estates, you have 100% owner, utility of your property. No one else can assert any rights in it, and so there's no need for the easement. But when there's not commonality, perfect commonality of ownership, then you run into the problem that you only have partial ownership in the serving estate, and you would have to get the other tenant in common's permission to establish an easement, to use the property, specifically to use it pertinent to the neighboring property. And so all of the the factors that go into the merger principle simply are not there when there's not a perfect unity in ownership of the properties.
Okay. Are you going to show us a picture of this thing?
I am.
Please.
I'll start with a picture of the 2002 class.
Still pretty blurry.
Mm-hmm. It's better.
Is that any better?
Yeah.
Getting better.
It's better.
Mm-hmm. All right. Point out the relevant
Council,
you have to stand in front of the microphone, please.
This is the Costerman property along these lines here. And then over here, you can see the outermost boundaries of the 66-foot easement path. And this is Highway 31 here. This is to the north, this is to the west, and to the east. Now, this is the proposal that AKG had submitted in the year 2002. As you can see, several of the parcels, about a handful of them, are platted over top of the Costerman easement. What I'd like to show you next is the 2003 plat, because I think it's important to recognize here that this is not about whether or not AKG can develop a subdivision. It's only a question about how many parcels does it get to develop, because what they did is they submitted this plat in 2003 showing parcels that do not impact the Costerman easement. So again, you have the Costerman property here. You have their easement, the northernmost boundary out here, and Highway 31 here. And here are all of the other parcels they were able to develop. And right now, this Outlot 11 could be developed into other parcels. So this does not even establish the ultimate number of parcels they could develop in the subdivision.
Council, would you show us where the cul-de-sac is and the proposed road and the outlot?
Certainly. That doesn't show in the 2003 plat because that has been removed. In the 2002 plat, the cul-de-sac is here with the road running up to either Lewis or Cobblestone Drive, depending on the iteration of the plat, and then out to Highway 31.
And where is the outlot, and how does that impact, if at all, the facts in this case?
Well, the outlot that would that AKG proposes to transfer to the Costermans is this small triangular piece of property here.
And then the Costerman's house is where?
Costerman's house is this outline here, and that shows the approximate proper location and orientation.
So what does he do, go through the cul-de-sac to get out?
He would have to go to the Costermans would have to go to the cul-de-sac to get out. They'd have to change their driveway and their access to their house in order to utilize that.
Who pays for that?
I'm sorry?
Who pays for changing the driveway?
Well, in the courts that have adopted the doctrine of changed circumstances, it is the serving estate owner that would pay for those changes.
I am sorry. I don't understand how these folks have been getting to their house over the years.
Okay. There is currently a gravel driveway between their house and Highway 31. So here's their house. There's a piece of the driveway that comes out to the easement, and then there's about a 30-foot strip of gravel all the way out to Highway 31.
And they can go right out on 31?
Yes.
You'll have to move the microphone again, please.
Thank you. That has been the use of the 1961 easement since its inception. It is its use today, and it will be its use tomorrow. There's nothing in the record to indicate that anything has or will happen to reduce the utility of the easement. Now, the doctrine of changed circumstances, one of the prerequisites to its application is that it be impossible to use the easement as it exists. And that's simply not the case here. It's perfectly possible to use the easement as it exists. It fulfills its purpose perfectly. It is ingress and egress between Highway 31 and the Kosterman House. Nothing has changed to interrupt that at all, other than AKG's plan to put houses on top of it.
Has the state ever said, you can't use that driveway anymore?
They have not. And in fact, in the 2002 plat, AKG proposed using a small part of the easement path as access for Lot 33. So even in AKG's proposal, there's no plan to eliminate vehicular access on this path from Highway 31. All they want to do is terminate it between Lot 33 and the Kosterman House so they can plat a couple extra parcels. Now, the Court of Appeals did not cite to any authority for the proposition that the doctrine of changed circumstances could be applicable in the state of Wisconsin. The closest they came was Millen v. Thomas. What they said was they were lifting dicta from Millen v. Thomas to the rule of law. But the language that they took from Millen was actually taken from this Court's decision in Niefeld v. Evan, a case that stood for precisely the opposite proposition for which the Court of Appeals asserted it. Now, further, because the doctrine of changed circumstances, by its terms and specifically as applied by the Court of Appeals, is at its most basic level balancing, it is a question of, do the needs and interests of the serving estate owner for his property right outweigh the needs and interests of the dominant estate owner for that property right? But this Court has said that kind of balancing as a means of determining whether to take a property right from one person and give it to another is completely inappropriate. In fact, in the Schwab v. Timmons case, Mr. Schwab came to the Court and asked for the imposition of an easement of necessity across his neighbor's property because his land on the shores of Green Bay could not be developed without that easement. The Court looked at his request as proposing a sort of a reasonable use test. That is, I should be able to get whatever property rights from my neighbor that I need to make reasonable use of my property. This Court rejected that proposition in very strong terms. It said the petitioner suggests, quote, that this Court set forth a reasonable use test that balances the equities by weighing the competing interests of the need and benefit to allow access by easement to develop otherwise useless land versus the detriment such a burden may place on other property to use an existing road. The petitioners insist that the benefit and policy towards development far outweigh any anticipated costs to the burden property, close quote. But the Court rejected that, saying, quote, in order to adopt the petitioner's proposal, we would have to ignore not only long-standing precedent in this state, but also well-established public policy as illustrated in our recording and conveyance statutes. Now, Goose v. Floor is one of those pieces of longstanding precedent. That case dealt with whether or not an easement could be unilaterally relocated, not even terminated, just moved. And this court looked at the equities of the situation in that case and concluded that the change in the easement would benefit both the servient and the dominant estate owners. And still this court said, we will not even allow you to move an easement unless you have consent of both the dominant and serving estate owners. And this court looked at what the motivations might have been of the objecting landowner and said this: it appears from the record that the refusal of the plaintiff to permit the removal of the fence is unneighborly, spiteful, and unreasonable. However that may be, the legal rights of the plaintiff remain the same. The mere fact that he does not choose to obey the golden rule and do unto others as he would have others do unto him does not change his legal rights. And then this court said, there can be no balancing of equities in this case.
Counsel, what rule of law do you want this court to set forth in this case?
I would like the court to reaffirm the holding in Nephi v. Evans. The serving estate owners may not unilaterally terminate or move expressly granted easements over defined paths.
Is that confined to expressed in writing easements, or is it also apply to implied easements?
It would apply to prescriptive easements. It would not apply to easements of necessity. In Niefeld, in particular, this court distinguished easements by necessity and said that they do terminate when the need for them goes away. So the rule that I propose, the rule that this court first announced in Niefeld v. Evans, would not cover easements by necessity. And this would actually be a melding of Niefeld v. Evans and Goose v. Floor. Goose v. Floor, and a very closely related case, Lehner v. Kozlowski, stand for the proposition that easements over defined paths may not be moved absent mutual consent. So what I'd like to see is Niefeld and Goose reaffirmed by this court to establish the easements that are expressly granted or acquired by prescription over defined paths may not be terminated or relocated unilaterally. Now, is
terminated? What about changed?
Changed either.
Terminated or changed. So it doesn't matter if I don't use it?
It does not matter.
I only use it once a week just to show that I'm in control of it?
The state of Wisconsin recognizes the concept of abandonment as a means of terminating.
That's why I'm doing it once a week. I'm not abandoning it. But there's another way out, let us just assume, and I use that, which is open to everybody.
If there is non-use has never been held to be sufficient for abandonment, it can be evidence of intent to abandon, but there must be intent to abandon.
So even if it's useless, but I don't abandon, and I do everything to show I don't abandon, that easement remains, under your theory.
Well, I think I would distinguish what you mean by useless. If by useless you mean that, say, Highway 31 gets abandoned, there's no more public road there anymore, I think in that case the doctrine of impossibility would apply, and the easement would be terminated at that point because it's not possible to use it anymore. However, if there are multiple points of access to the Klosterman home, one of which being the easement,
right.
It's not useless. I mean, they can still use it for the purpose, and they may choose to use it for the purpose that, for which it was granted. And on that basis, because it's not useless, it should not be. It could not be terminated under this court's precedence, and it could not be terminated without throwing a lot of easements across the state into jeopardy. Because then the question becomes, well, what is their intent in driving over that driveway once a week?
Did you brief the takings issue below?
We did not brief it in the Court of Appeals because it was the Court of Appeals' decision that constituted the taking. And the reason for that is there were two easements at issue in the Court of Appeals. The first was a 1998 easement that contained a condition subsequent. We do not believe the Court of Appeals correctly construed the language in that easement. They construed it to terminate once public road access is given over any path. However, the Court gave no rationale for why the 1961 easement would be terminated just because the 1998 easement would be terminated. That constituted a taking because it took a property right from the Kostermans and donated it to AKG. In the state of Wisconsin, it is unconstitutional as an exercise of eminent domain or governmental authority to transfer property rights between individuals, even when just compensation is granted. There has to be a public purpose for it. And we have an entire statute devoted to that very proceeding. It's Chapter 32, eminent domain. And if this is such an important piece of real property right for the community, there is a means by which the community can acquire it. They can engage the engine of eminent domain, get an appraisal, give notice, make a jurisdictional offer, have an opportunity to contest the hearing, the taking, and an opportunity to contest the amount of the award. And I see my time is up if there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Hankel, representing AKG Real Estate.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Attorney Hankel, representing AKG Real Estate, LLC. AKG is a limited liability company that was created by four families to develop this one subdivision and also, incidentally, to provide a place for them to build their family homes. Lost in all of this argument concerning easements, which I do intend to address, is an important facet of the case, and that has to do with contract law. This particular land was conveyed by the Quilichecks, Mr. and Mrs. Edward Quilichek, to AKG Real Estate back in 1998. Along with that conveyance, the Quilichecks reserved, by the way, by warranty deed, also conveyed by the White estate, which had to be a trustee's deed because it was an estate. But the Quilichecks, by warranty deed, gave over everything that they had, all the title they had, to the AKG LLC by virtue of the conveyance of his property. That would necessarily have to include all property rights that the Quilichecks had. Whether there was or wasn't merger, that becomes relevant at this point of the entire process.
Counselor, didn't the warranty deed exclude easements of record, and isn't the 1961 easement an easement of record?
I take the position that that would be easements of record that belong to third parties. The Quilichecks gave a warranty deed warranting title, and they expressly excluded. Their attorney drafted the document, and they expressly excluded three easements, one on Lewis Road, which is called Cobblestone, which is what the AKG Real Estate developer and engineers have proposed as the access to the subdivision, the other being the access easement, which, by the way, was not 66 feet but was 30 feet, which also, incidentally, is all that the Department of Transportation allows by way of access to Highway 31. You can't even build a road there given the Department of Transportation's current position. And also a sanitary easement. These were carefully drafted and specifically provided with respect to the easement on the private road that it would terminate upon the construction of public road access. That was a major issue in the trial court and the Court of Appeals. That's been decided in both places and is not appealed to this court that particular easement did terminate. Why in the world would the Quilichecks and their attorney have drafted a document expressly preserving a 30-foot easement at the same location of this 66-foot easement if they thought in their wildest dreams that they were still holding that right and had not conveyed it by virtue of a warranty deed?
Counsel, please.
Thank you. Mr. Hankel, you mentioned, let me ask you about your opposing counsel's reply brief saying, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation here, Gojmerik versus Mahon, a Court of Appeals decision from 2001 for the proposition that if a grantor fails to recite the easement and the deed, it is not extinguished, but it passes to the grantee. You take issue with that.
That would be true with respect to the Kosterman conveyance. Concededly, if that easement's still there, it goes with the conveyance, and I don't contend otherwise. The law is, if there's an appurtenant easement, it goes along with that property. But in this case, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that it is the property, the servant estate is being conveyed by warranty deed by the parties that hold, that own the dominant estate. And they do it by warranty deed. And they expressly exclude what they want to exclude. They've got that access easement that they want. That's what they wanted to exclude. This is a matter of contract interpretation. At least that's our position. What did this deed from Kulichek to AKG convey? What it conveyed was all the rights of the Kulichek in that 79-acre parcel, more or less, except for the three easements that had been expressly excluded, as drafted by the attorney for the Kulicheks. And this is no windfall. AKG paid. This is the record is replete with evidence that every party to this transaction and their attorneys assumed and believed that what was being conveyed was everything except that access easement, which would exist until such time as a public road was constructed. They paid. AKG paid for that. This is not a windfall case. What has happened is that as this has developed, it has now turned into a disaster for them in terms of losing a substantial portion of their subdivision. Can they develop part of it? Yeah, they've gone back and have reconfigured the subdivision so they can develop some of it. But by my calculation, they lose upwards of 7 lots of this subdivision by virtue of this access easement. And part of the reason for that is the Department of Transportation, as Susan Voigt's affidavit establishes and confirms, will not permit a road to be constructed at that location. It doesn't matter whether the department is looking at plat approval. That was inspired in 1999, and that got things like this going. But the point is, right now, any governmental authority looking at this is not going to approve a road at that location. Clearly, that was contemplated by the parties way back in 1961. Otherwise, why would we have a 66-foot road right-of-way replacing an earlier right-of-way of 30 feet? 66-foot road right-of-way is a right-of-way for a public road. The public road is no longer possible. It's not necessary at that location. The Kulicheks didn't want it. What they wanted, according to Mr. Kulichek's deposition testimony, is assurance that they have access to their home.
The language of the 61 easement, if I understood it correctly, was forever, not until no longer needed. And that's the trouble I'm having with your argument, is that if you look to the language of the easement itself, it kind of defines its own terms, does it not?
It does, but I go back to the point that I think is valid here, and that is that the contract, the sale contract, the counteroffer, which is part of our appendix at page 303, the supplemental appendix, the contract conveyed everything except what was reserved. And what was reserved is expressly stated. The 30-foot easement, which is on the 66-foot easement. Why, it boggles the mind. Why would somebody have reserved a 30-foot easement on the same location of a 66-foot easement if you really thought that you still had possession of that 66-foot easement? The Kulicheks gave a warranty deed to these folks, and by doing that, they gave up everything they had except what they preserved, which was adequate access to their home.
Counsel, let's look at the language since you're making the contract argument. And I'm looking in the appendix at appendix 69, which is the trustee deed of White to your client. And the same thing appears with regard to the deed of Gillette. How do you pronounce the name? Chidlet?
Kulicheck.
Boy, I got that wrong. Kulicheck, and that's on page 73. But I'm looking at on page 69 just because it's clearer print. So you have a warranty deed or a trustee deed. The language is the same here. And the deed then conveys everything except therefrom the following to wit. Recorded and or existing easements and right of way reservation. Now, et cetera. So then you look on 69, you go to look to see what these deed reservations are, and it's on page 71. And 71 has the first of the deed reservations. There are three, as you indicated. The first is relevant for us. The first says, and I won't read it entirely, but it says, reserving therefrom a private road assessment for the benefit of the homesteaders until such time as public road access is made available for said real estate upon the following described easement of right of way. Now, I don't mean to parse prepositions. That's from last case. They said, the attorney arguing the last case said, what are we going to do, parse prepositions? I thought, that's what we do all the time. But I don't mean to parse prepositions. But it says, until such time as public road access is made available for said real estate upon the following described easement of right of way. And then it goes to describe the, the relevant 30 feet or 33 feet here. So what am I missing in that contractual language?
Well, what you're missing is that issue is not on appeal. That issue was tried at the trial court. The trial judge found that that word upon, parsing the preposition, referred to the easement description and not to the location of the road. The Court of Appeals affirmed that, and no appeal has been taken from that finding. That finding is the law of the case, that upon refers to the description of the easement.
And then the circuit court also found, following up on Justice Butler's question, with regard to the 61, there was no condition, and it remains whether it express or not express in subsequent conveyances a valid easement. Is that the circuit court's opinion?
The circuit court found that, and I don't believe directly confronted the contract argument. We can or cannot. I'm not disparaging Judge Constantine, who's a fine judge, but I don't believe, and I contend that contract issue has never been decided. And the Court of Appeals didn't get to it either, because it went to the easement question, which I still intend to get to. But the primary and the first argument, without even getting into the question of when an easement is gone, modified, terminates, or whatever, is what did the Korolchuks convey to AKG? And they conveyed to AKG everything that they had in that property except what they reserved. And they reserved that 30-foot right-of-way, which the courts have determined, as law of the case, disappears upon providing public road access to the parcel. Obviously, that has to be adequate public road access. There are many questions that still will remain to be resolved, depending on whether this court affirms the courts below. That does not end the matter. Probably doesn't end the matter either way. But that's the position that we take, that easement is gone because it was surrendered. It was abandoned.
On the contract, actually.
It was abandoned as part of the contract.
Now on to your easement argument.
Okay. Thank you. The easement, in this case, according to the Court of Appeals, you can look at it in two ways, actually implicates two sections of the restatement of property servitudes, one being 7.10, the primary provision relating to change conditions, the second being 4.8, which is the relocation rule for easements. Contrary to what Mr. Kelly contends, I believe that the court will find that the trend of the law, of the recent law, is toward adoption of the principles set forth in both of those particular sections of the restatement. Frankly, there is much more law in section 4.8, which was not the focus in the trial court, but has become that since the Court of Appeals decision, than there is with respect to 7.10. Are there contrary cases back and forth? Sure there are. Is there a contrary argument back and forth? Certainly. But the better rule is when an easement no longer serves, its purpose can't be fulfilled. And here we skip over the fact that these easements, 61 and the easement in 98, All of these easements were designed to ensure access to the Quilichek, later Kosterman property, until such time as public road access was provided. When that public road access is provided, the purpose disappears. The Kostermans contend that that public road access has to be at the location of their driveway. That cannot occur. DOT will not allow it. It is impossible. The purpose of that condition has been frustrated. It's the same thing that was anticipated when the 1961 easement was granted, and that is with the 66-foot road right-of-way. That purpose cannot be fulfilled at that location.
Mr. Hankel?
Let me interrupt you, if I might. If we follow the trend, as you argue restatement reflects the trend, are we causing uncertainty in land law and property law in the state of Wisconsin?
No, because the clauses, the provisions in the restatement are limited, as is the Court of Appeals decision in this case, limited to very specific circumstances where there's impossibility of fulfilling a purpose of the easement description, but the servant estate, the dominant estate still is not harmed by the change, and in fact, I would argue in this case, it's benefited. It's got to, the customers are going to get a paved public road, no future maintenance obligations. They don't have to pay for anything. They're going to get property transferred to them. They're clearly going to gain significant benefits if this road is constructed by AKG, and it can't be constructed where they want it to be. It has to be at another location from Lewis Road.
Counselor, if I understand your argument correctly, it only has to be at another location if AKG is allowed to put subdivision on its property where it puts it, correct?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I missed that, Justice Butler.
The purpose is only frustrated. In other words, the customers can't put a road there, according to DOT, if AKG is allowed to build the subdivision in the location that it wants to build, correct? I mean, there's a condition precedent to altering the location of the easement. In other words, you can move it by your argument as long as AKG can put its subdivision where it wants to put it, correct?
Well, as long as AKG can construct a road to the Kosterman property. Right now, AKG can't construct a road to
the
Kosterman property.
You're from where I am. I'm at the point where the AKG wants to build the subdivision to begin with. In other words, activity on the AKG property is necessarily impacting on the Kosterman property. Correct?
Yes, they're connected.
I'm just trying to draw the lines here. And where you get this impossibility argument is if AKG can put its cul-de-sac in the location where it wants to put the cul-de-sac, then it would be impossible to put a road through that cul-de-sac, right?
It's impossible to put a road through that cul-de-sac in that location no matter what. You cannot build a road there. The DOT will not allow it.
Well, DOT won't allow it if AKG can build.
Am I
missing something here?
No, DOT will not allow it under any circumstances. It's a 30-foot. Well, it's a 30-foot access easement for a private driveway presently, and in fact, the way it's now constituted, it's only supposed to be to one parcel. So that actually parcel 33 can't use it either unless there's a change in that. DOT, through Susan Boyd's affidavit, has clearly said DOT will not allow a road at that location. AKG first presented plans with a road at that location and was denied the right to construct the subdivision in that regard, or told that it would not be permitted. They've gone to the DOT several times. They've gone to the county. Susan Boyd has made it clear, and she's the director, and things change, maybe we get another lawsuit down the road, but as it stands right now, AKG cannot get a plat approved in that location, or can't construct a road in that location even without a plat. Could not happen. State will stop it. And right now, I'm not sure the way the law works now because Caledonia's turned into a village, but presumably the village planning of the former town of Caledonia, now independent of the county, would prevent that from that kind of approval, road approval. A public road can't be built there given the current state of DOT regulations and position of their executives and managers as they interpret that regulation.
Counsel, I look at in the Court of Appeals opinion regarding this issue, and it seems like they're a little equivocal, at least with the record that was presented to the Court of Appeals. It says the parties don't tell us, paragraph 10, parties don't tell us how close Valley Road lies to the easement path, and then the Court of Appeals does a little bit of its own independent investigation, and it says it could be this or it could be that. We have figures ranging from less than 300 feet, 400 feet, and roughly 500 feet. And then, of course, the engineer testified in his deposition that experience with the DOT, it prefers 1,000 feet, but as a rule of thumb, generally tolerates as few as 600 feet. And when I was reading this, I thought, do we have a question of fact with regard to distance here? I mean, it seems...
I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, I can't cite you to the record, but I think the record is clear that the distance from Valley Road to this private driveway is somewhere in the vicinity of 500 feet, less than 600 feet. And that's partly the explanation for Susan Voigt's opinion that a road's not going to be permitted in that location. They allow flexibility. And in fact, the 233.06, the court can see, was changed to allow some flexibility in handling this, dealing with practicality. The fact is there is a road now at Lewis Cobblestone Road that provides access to the back area, and DOT, given its, I don't believe they're going to approve it, again, short of another lawsuit somewhere.
Let me just ask you this. You view this, the purpose of the easement road, as lasting only until public access. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then your argument is once that public access is given, the easement falls of its own weight.
But falls by a matter of law, as a matter of law, based upon an order of a court. The court's got to look at it, and the court will, you know, contrary to what may have been implied, and maybe we've implied in an argument, the Kostermans will have a right to intervene in any proposed construction. That the cul-de-sac that's a non-starter right now. That's not the case. That's not the way it's going to be unless it's subsequently approved. The Kostermans will have an opportunity to interject themselves into the approval process through hearings, through planning commission, and through board action. Thirdly, the court will, if it determines that they have indeed lost something of value, have to provide them with compensation for what they've lost, as one looks at the restatement. I think the restatement is correct in that regard. I certainly agree with it, that if there is any kind of financial detriment, they should be compensated for that.
What kind of rule of law do you want to come out of this case?
First of all, I'd like the court to agree with me on the contract claim, but aside from that, the rule of law that I think the court should adopt is, I believe, well stated in the restatement, both sections 4.8 of the restatement, third servitudes, and section 7.9.
Precisely what language covers this case? I mean, this covers a whole load of cases or fact situations.
The 4.8 language in sub 3 would allow the modification or change of an easement if that change would not significantly lessen the utility of the easement, and if it would not increase the burdens on the owner of the easement in its use and enjoyment, or frustrate the purpose for which the easement was created. That's one applicable provision. The other provision would be in 7.10, which has to do with the modification and termination of a servitude because of changed conditions. And I'll quote the language of the restatement. When a change has taken place since the creation of a servitude that makes it impossible...
Change here.
Pardon me?
What's the change here?
The change here is the inability or the impossibility of constructing a road access at the location that was anticipated way back in 1961.
Right.
40-some years ago.
When a change has taken place since the creation, go ahead.
And makes it impossible as a practical matter, and the DOT position makes it impossible to put a road there, to accomplish the purpose for which the servitude was created, which was to provide a public road, a court may modify the servitude to permit the purpose to be accomplished, which in this case would be providing a public road to the Kostermans property with no cost to them. If modification is not practical, the court can terminate the servitude. We're not contending that should take place. We are contending that the Kostermans are certainly entitled to access, which AKG wants to provide via a public road.
Mr. Hankel, what about Mr. Kelly's argument, pages 19 and 20 of his brief, that the change conditions doctrine does not apply to easement and only applies to use restrictions?
That clearly is the evolution of the law. It starts from contract law, restrictive covenants. The Cortese case, a decision by Justice Kennedy, I believe, does start with a restricted covenant case and analyzes it that way. But before they get to the restrictive covenant, they talk about change conditions and then say, well, we have a restrictive covenant here, and this is why we adopt this. Clearly, the restatement took that trend of the law with respect to restrictive covenants and carried it on. And the question is whether the trend of the law, whether that is the trend of the law, and if it is the trend, even if it is the trend of the law, whether this court wants to adopt that or approve the Court of Appeals adoption of it.
When we talk about trend of the law, this restatement was promulgated, if you will, in 2000. Is that correct?
It may have been 1999 or something like that.
I mean, so it's relatively recently.
Yes,
I know
relative.
One of the opinions that you rely on is what I refer to as the MGM. That might not be exactly.
It's MGM.
I know, it's close enough. MGM. And in there, this whole issue of minority and majority view, there's a footnote that makes it clear that the majority of jurisdictions disagree with your approach.
At least as of the date of adoption of the restatement.
What date is the MPM case when they make that statement? I mean, it's not important, but it's a 2004 case.
Yes, according to what I have, 2004.
Okay, so at least then the majority are against your position. But your argument is since the restatements were finalized, whether it's 1999 or 2000, the jurisdictions that have looked at this seem to be going your way. Is that what you're arguing?
That's my argument. MPM case states that, it's referring to the cases that predate adoption of the restatement. And since adoption of the restatement, I believe, based on my review of the cases, only some of which are cited in the brief, that the trend of the law, at least with respect to the adoption of 4.8, Section 4.8 of the restatement, is definitely in favor of adoption, at least looks on it with favor. In some cases, there are wrinkles placed upon it. What I hadn't quite gotten to with respect to 7.10 is the restatement does say compensation for resulting harm to the dominant estate may be awarded as a condition of the modification or terminating the servitude. The Kostermans have retained considerable power in this case to impose costs, expenses, requirements, force modifications of design. Regardless of what the court may decide here, they still retain that power. They do not lose that right. They do not lose what the Korachek's were concerned about retaining, and that is the right of access and egress to their property. A lot of discussion has occurred, and Mr. Kelly raised a lot of points regarding the desirability of preserving the law the way it is. As we all know, this is a common law decision, and common law, I think Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in his book Common Law emphasized it, that what we have to do is look at what is and what has been and also what the law will tend to be. It's not something that is frozen in time.
I want to go back to your contract argument that you made, because I don't think we've really spent much time on that. And I have this question for you. You referred us to pages where we can see what the purchase contract was in regard to this. There's also a deed that has been provided. If there's a conflict between the purchase contract and the deed, which document controls our decision?
Well, the deed, unless there's an ambiguity, which the court would have to analyze, then you can look at extrinsic evidence such as negotiations, testimony, offers to purchase, and there may or may not be an ambiguity. Perhaps there is. Both sides in this case have argued there isn't, with leading to different results. Maybe that leads to the conclusion that we're both wrong. But no, otherwise it would be the deed that, you know, if it's just looking at the four corners of the document and the document speaks for itself, it is what it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hankel. Mr. Kelly, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kelly, before you get started, I'm going to be really bad and ask you, is there a conflict between the contract to purchase this land and the deed that was recorded?
That's actually a very fine question that we don't have an answer to. That was not the subject of discovery in the circuit court. There is a possibility that certainly you could, if you wished, find some daylight between what happened in the written recorded and the written negotiation history versus what the deed is. But we have nothing to indicate whether there how the meetings of mind came together that eventually resulted in that deed. But as you pointed out, the deed is the document that controls. It is unambiguous. And that does provide that that all recorded easements were accepted from what was transferred to AKG. And if we are going to talk about what parties knew when, AKG surely knew that it was not getting the 1961 easement. First, there are the two deeds, the trustee deed and the warranty deed, that provides that all written, all recorded easements are accepted. There's the title commitment that they received, which lists as item number 17, the 1961 easement that was accepted. And they knew themselves as they were planning this land that the 1961 easement still existed. Because if I were to blow up the, and it's shown in our appendix, but if I were to blow up the 2002 plat, you'll see on there where they have demarcated the 66-foot wide 1961 easement. So everyone knew what was being transferred when. And the Kwilichek's knew that they were accepting the 1961 easement because when you look at the Kwilichek deed to the Kostermans, that specifically refers to both the 1998 easement and the 1961 easement. So the Kwilichek's knew that they were accepting out the 1961 easement. Second, I'd like to make sure that I'm very clear on the point of the purpose of an easement, because I think AKG gets this point precisely backwards. The purpose of an easement is to grant the dominant estate owner the right to do something. It is not to grant the Serbian estate owner the right to do something. Easements always and everywhere benefit only the dominant estate. There's no purpose for an easement to benefit the Serbian estate because they can make any use of their property they want that's not inconsistent with the easement. The 1961 easement does one thing and one thing only. It allows for an access path between the Kosterman House and Highway 31. That is its only purpose. If we are going to talk about the doctrine of changed circumstances, we first have to conclude that that purpose is impossible. And it's not. Whether or not it is possible to build a public road over that path is not the issue. The only question is, can it continue to be used as a driveway by the owners of the Kosterman property?
Well, as defined by opposing counsel, the easement had a purpose of lasting until public access. You just disagree with that.
The 1998 easement lasted until public road access was granted over that path, and I agree with Justice Bradley's reading of that language, and I think we do need to parse prepositions on that point. But that is not before the court simply because the Court of Appeals said, let's set that aside. We're going to adopt the doctrine of changed circumstances, and regardless of what the condition subsequent says, we're going to eliminate it anyway. So while we do disagree with the Court of Appeals' decision on the language on the conditions subsequent in the 1998 easement, the real issue today here is whether the doctrine of changed circumstances is used to unilaterally terminate or relocate easements.
Easements, or the 61 easement, or the 98 easement?
The 1961 easement, and that's the one that we are here concerned with. It contains no condition subsequent. It does last in perpetuity until the parties agree, until the marketplace brings them together, and they agree to do something different with it.
Now, if this were the 98 easement, what would you say?
If this were the 1998 easement, I would say that, and we were arguing that in its entirety, I would say that that easement does not terminate until public road access is granted over top of that easement. And let's just say, let's just assume for the point of argument that Trans 233 actually is a changed circumstance, and that, in fact, it wasn't adopted in 1956. Let's say it was a changed circumstance. That does not mean a changed circumstance within the meaning of the doctrine, because all that does is eliminates the possibility of performing the conditions subsequent. The purpose of the easement was never to create a public road. The purpose of the easement was to create a driveway. It would terminate as a driveway if a public road was dedicated over that path. And if that condition subsequent becomes impossible to do, that does not mean that the purpose of the easement was impossible. But set that to the side, the 1961 easement is the easement that controls in this case. It is unconditional, has no condition subsequent, performs the same purpose today that it did in 1941. It would be a takings to transfer that from one property owner to another. It would incorporate a very corrosive concept into the real property law of the state of Wisconsin, destroy capital, create uncertainty, increase litigation, and I believe it's a policy this court would be well served to avoid. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Hankel, for your arguments today about dominant and servient estates and easements. We appreciate your coming. If you wish to stay to hear Justice Prosser, by all means do so. We now terminate our hearing in 2004-AP-188, AKG versus Kosterman. The court will reconvene for another oral argument at 1:30.